From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
There's a lot of crap in Madison. There's also a lot of crap in London and New York and Los Angeles. I mean, to think that any locale produces nothing but terrific music or art or literature or anything is just mind-boggling.
That's music critic John Mendelson, someone who clearly doesn't mince his words. Mendelson will tell us about what it's like to dish out criticism and to be on the receiving end of it through his work as a musician, as we explore arts criticism today. Also, the rock critic who jammed with the Rolling Stones on clarinet, Robert Palmer.
I think Bob saw music and heard music as a route to that other world.
And how Brian Eno's Oblique Strategies cards influenced both the making of his album Another Green World and the writing of a book about it.
There's a really great one that just says, go outside. and that is like, that solves half of the world's problems, I'll tell you, that card.
But first, Manola Dargis. Dargis is co-chief film critic for The New York Times. She grew up in Manhattan's East Village, but now lives in Los Angeles. Dargis told Steve Paulson what she thinks the role of film criticism is.
I don't know if I want to get too grandiose, but I see my own role as being someone who can be part of a conversation. I see movie reviewing, movie criticism, and some people make a distinction between the two, but I tend not to, as just part of a conversation. And we tend to be among the very first people in that conversation. It's part of a long discourse. I always try to respond to my email, at least the kind of more civilized email. I don't really have that kind of relationship that, let's say, bloggers have with their commentators. I always do think of it as part of an ongoing conversation about the movies. That's really what I see it as, is to, you know, I have long experience. I've watched a lot more movies than most normal people. I think I have an abnormal and I can, as a consequence, bring to bear a lot of knowledge. But I just see myself as part of an ongoing conversation.
Well, it's really interesting hearing you say that, because you have avoided words like pointing out what's good or bad about a film, which I think most people would assume is what critics are supposed to do.
Yes, I think it's trying to get beyond a kind of Manichaean idea about, you know, how you look at a movie. There are movies that are, you know, very blatantly terrible, and, you know, those are often the most amusing films to write about, unfortunately. Perhaps it's all the stuff in between that's a lot more interesting. And part of the role of the critic, I think, should be that you help people look at movies and to kind of understand that movies are not just stories, they're visual stories. There's a different kind of way of telling a story that happens in a movie that happens differently in a book, even though, let's say, a lot of people don't really attend to those differences, perhaps as much as they should. And my role, in part, is to kind of say, look how this person is shooting this. See how meaning is leaking into the image and what the director, for instance, is trying to say without actually using dialogue.
But that almost sounds like you're writing more for people who've actually seen the movie, because then they can respond to the specifics that you're saying, whereas I'm guessing that maybe most people who read your reviews have not seen the movie and are trying to figure out whether they should go or not.
I think that I do that a little bit. I'm not doing a close analysis of the sort that you would find in an academic journal. You know, I'm not doing count shots. I'm not saying, you know, at 22.3 minutes into the film, you'll see a lateral pan, et cetera. I'm not doing that kind of close analysis. What I am is just is the way that you would find an art critic, someone like Peter Sheldahl in The New Yorker. And, you know, he's wonderful, and I'm not even suggesting I'm like that. And among other things, I don't usually have the room, the space in the paper to kind of make those longer, more leisurely arguments. When an art critic writes about a painting, they're going to tell you if the artist has worked in watercolor, oil, acrylic. I think that it's important with movies to also describe, did someone shoot in digital? How does that look specifically versus how it looks if it was shot in celluloid? You know, it's not too specific, but I'm also trying to bring that into the conversation as much as plot details. Plot is often the least interesting thing. Boy meets girl, so what? That's not even my original line. Apparently, I don't know if this is an apocryphal story, but that's a pitch that Bertolt Brecht was trying to sell to Hollywood back in the 1940s. I think he failed. But really, you can reduce a lot of movies to that. And so what else is there to write about? Do you really want to read just a plot summary? You know, you can go on. There's a lot of online sites that provide that service. I think that, you know, if you're reading a critic in the New York Times, you expect a different degree of engagement.
I have to ask about something that your colleague at the Times, A.O. Scott, recently wrote. He did an essay about arts criticism, and he said, "A remnant of over-entitled old media graybeards are fighting a rearguard action against the democratic forces of the internet, clinging to threadbare cultural authority in the face of their own obsolescence. Everyone's a critic, or maybe no one is." What do you think of that assessment?
Well, I think it's important to remember that this article that Tony wrote, which was published on April 4th, Tony being A.O. Scott, was couched as that the received wisdom is thus. This is a topic that we both of us return to again and again in our own conversations with each other. I don't think that Tony believes any more than I do that there's a crisis in criticism. What we completely understand working at the New York Times, where we had to take a 5% pay cut but are extremely lucky, unlike some of our other colleagues, that we still have jobs, is that there's a crisis in publishing. I find the kind of attempt that some people try to do to distinguish online, people who are strictly online and kind of old media or dead tree media or however you want to couch it, kind of ridiculous. You know, I've been online since the LA Weekly had a website. I reach millions of readers, which is a frightening idea. Every single day, week.
But I think what's changed is that if you want to just read about a movie and you go online just to see what's being said, you may be directed to a critic at the New York Times or the LA mm-hmm. Times, but you may not. I mean, probably most of the hits that are going to get pulled up are actually online reviews. And I guess it raises the question of whether people like you are becoming less important.
Absolutely not, because, I mean, I don't know about my own personal importance, but if you actually do a search on Google, the New York Times online review, and that's my point, my reviews are online. I don't see myself as a print journalist, and neither does the New York Times, from what I can tell, see itself as just a print. You know, it's not about print. It has one of the best websites. And I'm not going to do an advertisement for the Times. God knows they can do it themselves. But the fact is that we don't have that idea. We don't make that distinction at the paper. I don't see why everyone else continues to do it. It is a false dichotomy.
Hmm. Now, there was a time when...
I hear a bit of skepticism there.
No, it's really interesting hearing you say that. Yeah, and like, I like it, you know, actually. I like sort of the ringing defense of...
It's not a defense. It's a matter of empirical fact. You know, my mother reads me online. I personally get the paper because I'm old enough to actually really like walking around the house and like going outside and carrying my newspaper. But the fact is, most people read me online. These are different platforms. We are so beyond that false dichotomy. That's a discussion of a couple years ago. The Times, I think, and again, I would say that the Times is really in the vanguard in terms of using different platforms. I mean, the website is fantastic. Again, you know, when I write, my work is usually it's posted online before it's in a physical paper, mm-hmm. you know.
Do you think your reviews have much impact on a movie's success at the box office?
I think a positive review in the New York Times by one of the chief critics can certainly help and very possibly might hurt an independent film. I mean, the thing about big budget studio movies now is they basically buy their opening weekends with advertising. They really don't need critics. They're just going to have wall-to-wall advertising. Where we can help are the little movies that just don't have the money to buy big ads or television commercials. And it also depends on the placement. If a review is on, let's say, the cover of the paper, that's even better. You've hit the jackpot. If you've got a positive review from Tony or myself, you know, on the cover of the New York Times, that matters. But only for small movies.
Yeah. Do you worry about writing a negative review, especially of a low-budget, let's say, independent film? Do you feel some sense of responsibility that you might be killing that film?
No. My responsibility is chiefly to the truth of the movie as I see it. My responsibility is to my own honesty. My responsibility is to the reader. I can't worry about what was involved in the making of these movies. Movies are extremely difficult to make, no matter if they're huge blockbusters or really tiny little independents. They're difficult. They're labors of love. They're madness. But I can't think about that. That would be really crippling. What I can do, and I have done, and this is something that Tony and I do very quietly, is that if one of us really dislikes a movie and the other one really likes it, we will switch because nobody needs another negative review. You know, we don't do it all the time. We just do it on occasion.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you treat a review of a blockbuster, let's say Clash of the Titans, any differently than you would a more intelligent film like Fantastic Mr. Fox? Do you write it differently?
No, I don't write it differently. It just, you know, one's a terrible movie and one's a really great movie. So the adverbs and adjectives will definitely be different. The attitude, the pleasure with which I write, that will definitely be different. But I'm still sitting in my office and I'm still pecking away, you know. There's no real difference. And I don't take a kind of – I don't think that Hollywood movies, studio movies should be treated with – any differently than an independent film, in the sense that I'm going to be harder on them or, you know, meaner or whatever. That's just absurd. You know, you have to deal with the work in front of you, not with your own prejudices.
I've read that you sometimes get some nasty mail about some of your reviews, and maybe especially when you were writing for the LA Weekly. And in fact, didn't the second Garfield movie take a shot at you by naming the villain Lord Dargis?
Yes, I believe that they did. I think that's an extremely high compliment. I have friends who made me a wonderful T-shirt that I wear on occasion that says Lord Dargis. It's in kind of goth letters.
Manola Dargis is the co-chief film critic of the New York Times. She spoke with Steve Paulson. What kind of impact do you think the internet is having on arts criticism? What do you think the future of arts criticism is? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to our Facebook page. Coming up, the daughter of the late music critic Robert Palmer and one of his colleagues talk about Palmer's life and work. And we find out how Brian Eno used the studio as a musical instrument to create his 1975 album, Another Green World, as we continue to look at arts criticism. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Robert Palmer was a music critic and a musician. Yoko Ono once said that she, John Lennon, and Palmer touched each other's spirit. Robbie Robertson of The Band said that for Palmer, music was a religion. Palmer's fellow critic Anthony DeCurtis has edited a new book called Blues and Chaos, The Music Writing of Robert Palmer, and Palmer's daughter, Augusta Palmer, recently made a documentary about her father called The Hand of Fatima. In a rare joint interview, Anthony DeCurtis and Augusta Palmer joined Steve Paulson to talk about the life and work of Robert Palmer. DeCurtis explained what he liked so much about Palmer's writing.
I was always kind of struck by both the intelligence and the passion of his writing. I mean, as somebody who was in graduate school, I was really impressed by Bob's ability to bring sophisticated musical ideas to the mainstream, which is on my best day, what I'd like to feel I ended up doing as well. He set a kind of standard in that regard. And particularly, you know, in the kind of heyday of punk, I was in graduate school in Bloomington, Indiana, and I was reading Bob and John Rockwell in the New York Times, and those guys were just hammering. I mean, they were really covering a very insurgent and subversive music in the New York Times with the same kind of force that the New York Times was associated in covering other aspects of the arts. I mean, those guys did not make any distinction between something that was going on at CBGB and something that was going on at Lincoln Center. So that is a part of Bob that I really admired, you know, that ability to kind of walk into any musical environment and make some sense out of it and deliver that, his comprehension, to an audience.
And the way you put it in the introduction to your book, he blended elegance with hipster enthusiasm.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was a kind of sense. I mean, Robbie Robertson from The Band, you know, who knew Bob well and whom I interviewed for Bob's obituary, unfortunately, and for this introduction, you know, remarked about Bob, even as polite and friendly a person as he was, you know, there was a very clear sense on his part that he had better taste than just about anyone. And that was evident, you know, when you did speak to him in a way that was not particularly imposed. I mean, when Bob spoke, there was a feeling of, I want to put this in a way that doesn't sound pretentious, because there wasn't really any pretension in him. It was kind of like, this is what this is about, period. You know, there was a seriousness of intent, a kind of thing like, look, you know, I've given this a lot of thought. I care about it more than just about anyone. And here's my take.
Hmm. Well, and the other thing that comes through in a lot of the stuff that's been written about him is that music was more than just a passion for him. It was almost a religion. I mean, that's the word that some people use. And in fact, you say that he wasn't a religious person in any traditional sense, but it was through music that he sought transcendence.
Exactly. And I think that was a more complicated process. Yeah, I mean, for a variety of reasons. I mean, you know, certainly Bob struggled with addiction in his life. I think there were elements of his life that he very much wanted to transcend. And I think, you know, just like all of us, I mean, you feel trapped in your body and you feel, you know, you're in a world and you wonder what's beyond it. And I think Bob saw music and heard music as a route to that other world. And he found it in a lot of places and, again, managed to communicate it very effectively.
Well, Augusta, let me bring you into this discussion, because certainly this is one of the themes in your film about your father, that music was his religion. How far would you take that assessment?
Yeah, I would say that's absolutely true. And like Anthony said in the introduction, he wasn't a religious person in a kind of traditional or conventional sense of that, but he was a very deeply spiritual person and was really into understanding what made the world work. As his friend Bashir Attar of the Master Musician says, who mixes the ocean? He wanted to find that out. I do too.
But, fabulous.
Yeah, well, and clearly it came at a cost to those people closest to him, to you, over a period of time, to his various wives. You say his life was music, but that didn't always include you.
Well, I think because he was so hooked into that, I think it was really hard for him to make time and space for other people in his life if they didn't seem to be going along the same groove. Once I really got to know him as a teenager, you know, that wasn't so much of an issue. And actually, I think one thing that maybe doesn't come off as much as it could in the film is that we did actually develop a really great relationship, and that it was fantastic as a teenager to be talked to like an adult in that inclusive way. He would talk to me the same way he would talk to Anthony, or the same way he would talk to Yoko Ono, because he was just him. And he felt very confident in that and in having the best taste in the world.
But we should point out that he left your mother when you were 1 month old. And you say that he stayed totally out of your life until you were, what, 12?
Yes, that's true. And that's something that's hard to get over. I think there are a lot of complicated things that you could go into about why that was. He wanted to be in New York, and my mother and I lived in Little Rock, Arkansas. And I think it was also one of those things where once you've made that decision to go down that road, it's hard to make the U-turn and sort of admit that you've been wrong. So it took him a long time to do that, and probably took some pressure from other people in his life, like his wife at that time, Deborah Ray Cohen, and his mother, who, strangely enough, I think this is one of the most bizarre things about the story, is that I saw my grandmother, my dad's mother, every week. And his grandparents, my great-grandparents as well, were a big part of my life. But they never mentioned him.
We all respected him highly, especially the musicians. We all loved him. He was the conscience. He was the superb intelligence in the music world.
And what's remarkable for a man who became known mainly as a rock critic is how highly regarded he was by various prominent musicians, from Mick Jagger and Yoko Ono to Bono and the jazz great Ornette Coleman. This is practically unheard of for a music critic to be thought of so highly by these kinds of people.
Well, yeah, and I think part of that was that Bob neither pandered to these characters. nor did he kind of stint on the degree to which he admired them. Someone like Mick Jagger, I mean, the Rolling Stones were extremely important in Bob's thinking and also kind of as his buddies. And, you know, he didn't recognize a lot of those lines. I'm sure the New York Times wouldn't have been happy to learn Bob was up to whatever hours doing whatever things with Keith Richards listening to old blues records. You know, that's not in the journalism handbook. You know, it certainly is part of who he was, and I think it very much informed his writing about that band and about that music. He identified with musicians, and I think musicians felt a kindred spirit in him, I think.
And for one thing, he would sometimes jam with them, right? With, like, the Rolling Stones. I mean, he was playing music with them.
On clarinet, yeah, exactly. I mean, I think they enjoyed it. I mean, I think with someone like Ornette Coleman, I think that there was a kind of more serious quest going on there musically. I think Bob felt with the Rolling Stones, like, why shouldn't he be up there, you know, with his clarinet? I mean, Jagger, when he was telling me about that, was laughing. He'd always just, like, break out that clarinet and, you know, jam with us. And they enjoyed it. You know, they got a kick out of it, but it wasn't necessarily like, oh, this is really going to take this particular song to another level. Whereas I think, you know, with obviously with someone like Ornette, I think that was the goal. You know, I mean, I think they were going to the same place.
Hmm. What do you think he was looking for in music?
I think he wanted to get to some other place. I think that's what he wanted. And whether that was through the blues or through the master musicians of Jujuka or through, you know, really wild jazz, or I think he wanted to go. You know, that was his thing. You know, I think...
Go in what sense? In kind of a Dionysian sense?
Of, I yeah, mean, sort exactly.
Of, okay.
Let's get out of here.
The you know, Brian Gysin here to go. You know, that's what we're here for.
Yeah, or, you know, that kind of Tom Gysin, like, man, I got
to
go. Yeah, like that kind of sort of a beat thing, you know, and yeah, and that kind of transcendent, like let's just kind of, you know, turn on the jets here and set the controls for the heart of the sun. I think that's that was the drive.
I studied their music and their magic. Took part in trance rituals with hundreds of mountain tribesmen, and finally succumbed to the insistent trance rhythms myself. These and other experiences culminating in my adoption into the Attar family in 1973 called all my beliefs and assumptions about how the world works into question.
Now, one of the curiosities of Robert Palmer's story is why he gravitated so profoundly to the master musicians of Jujuka, this musical group in Morocco. Have either of you come to understand this?
I think I have, and I think a large part of that was by going there and being able to hear that music for hours and hours on end. I mean, in the film, you only get to hear it for a brief period, but part of the music, the way that music works on you, is by listening to it for 4 or more hours at a time, usually around 3 in the morning.
This is the kind of music that does take you somewhere?
It definitely takes you somewhere. When I talked to Donovan about that music, we had this great conversation. When I looked back at some of the footage, I was like, no one will have any idea what we're talking about. And that was actually the problem in making a film about Jujuka, because I would say to people, Jujuka, and they'd say, yeah, it was great.
Weren't there often also a lot of psychedelic drugs that were part of the musical experience?
Absolutely, absolutely, there were. One reviewer in the Times said maybe the drugs now aren't as good as they were back then. And that may be true, too. But I think that also misses the point of the experience, that it's really the purity of that music. And whatever you cut it with, if you want to cut it with LSD or a lot of keef, rock and mixture of pot and marijuana, that might help you out. But I think the music by itself has plenty to get you to another place.
Yeah, I should say, I mean, about the drugs, I mean, look, we all know they kill people. Yeah, we all know that they're dangerous. But people have been using drugs for centuries to enhance certain types of religious, spiritual experiences. And in part, that's what Bob was doing. He was also killing himself. There's no doubt about that. But there's part of him in those moments, like in Morocco, and I would say even in other situations where to just lose intellect, you know, or lose consciousness to just experience, to just be in the presence of that music. I think that was part of his goal. Part of his goal in Morocco, and I think part of his goal, even when he was doing things that would ultimately hurt him.
I'm reminded of something my dad once wrote. How much thought can be hidden in a few short lines of poetry? How much history can be transmitted by pressure on a guitar string? The thought of generations, the history of every human being who's ever felt the blues come down like showers of rain.
Anthony, I want to come back to the business of being a rock critic, because there are very different ideas about how one should do this. So I have to ask you, what makes a great critic?
Well, I like writers who are knowledgeable, who write well, and who aren't necessarily into, I don't know, kind of imposing themselves on their subjects. If you read Bob's writing, I mean, as much as, you know, he was in there with a lot of, I mean, he hung out with a lot of these people, when you read his writing, there's a certain reserve. For all that he knew, he's never condescending. There isn't any snarkiness. I mean, occasionally, like in writing about Madonna, for example, you know, I think that, you know, he kind of felt like, okay, look, if I've got to go do this, then, you know, this is what it is, and I can't even be bothered to think about it. But Bob was drawn to the things that he liked. He saw his job as kind of turning people on to things that he believed were important and that he thought were good.
Augusta, you say at the beginning of your film that it's been 8 years since your father died. I'm sure it's been more than that by now. But you also say you're still looking for him. Do you feel like you eventually found him?
I do. I feel like the process of making the film, and one of the greatest parts of that was making the animation that's based on his writing, some of which I actually made even before I went to Morocco, and other parts of which I made afterwards. I mean, that allowed me to kind of inhabit his voice in a way that was really wonderful for me. So that was a huge part. And then being in Jijuka and feeling a part of that family and feeling really moved by that music, when I approached it, I have to say with some skepticism before, that really surprised me and changed me. And I feel put me pretty closely in touch with him and who he was. My dad's encounter with Jijuka tied a knot in his heart that sometimes excluded me. But somehow, by retracing his footsteps, I found something I never expected. A family formed in music. A family unlike any other, but open to anyone who's willing to listen.
Augusta Palmer is the daughter of the music critic Robert Palmer. She's also the maker of a documentary about her father called The Hand of Fatima. Anthony DeCurtis is a longtime contributing editor at Rolling Stone. He's also the editor of the book Blues and Chaos, the music writing of Robert Palmer. DeCurtis and Augusta Palmer spoke with Steve Paulson. Gita Dayal is the author of Another Green World. It's a short book about Brian Eno's 1975 album of the same name. The book is part of Continuum's 33 and a third series of books about iconic albums. Brian Eno used a deck of oblique strategies cards to help him create Another Green World. The cards were created by Eno and his friend, the late artist Peter Schmidt. The cards contain phrases like, "Honor thy error as a hidden intention." They're designed to help you make creative decisions. So it was only fitting that Gita Dayal used these cards to help her write her book.
When you're starting a book and when you're writing a book, you're writing like 8 or 9 or 10 drafts. I can't tell you how many drafts of this book there are, but on my computer there's something like 30 or 40 drafts of this book. A lot of them weren't that destructive. That particular card I'm referring to is this oblique strategy that says, make a sudden, destructive, unpredictable action, incorporate.
Wow.
And most cards aren't like that. Most cards say things like, use a different color, So I changed the font color, you know, in the word processor I was using. There's a really great one that just says, go outside. and that is like, that solves half of the world's problems, I'll tell you, that card.
Well, it's really fascinating, isn't he? And he's full of contradictions. There are things that sound very accessible and then don't. At one point in the book, you write about some of Another Green World as practically meditative. But then you say the album itself was, I think your words were, an experiment fueled by adrenaline, panic, and pure faith.
Yeah, it was. The music itself is very sort of calming and delicately textured and very beautiful. But then the really interesting contrast is you think about how it was made. Can you imagine going into a studio with no music written down and a bunch of your friends and some hired session people and saying, okay, we're going to make an album. I don't know what it's going to sound like. We have 2 months. And studio time is really expensive. They're spending sometimes hundreds of pounds per day. It wasn't like you could just mess around on your laptop with some software and have your own home recording studio.
In Another Green World, I think you wrote that he tried some things like seeing how little he could tell them, to tell the musicians about what he wanted.
Yeah.
In order just to see what would happen.
I think I write about this in one of the chapters, that he got Phil Collins so wound up at one point that Phil was like throwing beer cans across the room, like was really, really angry. And he was just like, look, what do you want me to do? Eno had this idea that he wanted Phil to drum in this very sort of metronomic, mathematical way based on this very strange mathematical notation that Eno had laid out that had absolutely nothing to do with musical notation. I mean, Eno doesn't read music. The song Sky Saw, as I write, the first song on the album, the seed of Sky Saw was Eno just tapping on an A on a piano, just again and again, just tapping A in a certain rhythm, and that was sort of the genesis of the tune.
And where did it go from there? Just, I mean, that's not the way anybody else would start, unless something happens in your head, I guess, is there?
Yeah, I write in my book that he sort of plants these seeds in people's minds. Eno's very into things like gardening, and it's easy to see why. He's really into cooking, he's really into gardening, he's really into these things where you start out with these raw materials and you grow something new. You get something more complex, more exciting, more interesting as your result through some interesting process. The more that I learned about Eno, you know, I'd already been a fan of his work, but I was really seriously immersed in his life and work for probably almost 3 years. I really got a sense that everything Eno does is integrated very well to everything else he does. He's a real artist in that he has his concepts down, and the more you understand his work, the more you understand that absolutely everything he does relates in some interesting matrix to these other things that he's done.
There's a song on Another Green World called In Dark Trees, a very haunting song. Can you tell me about that one?
Yeah, it's a really interesting song in a lot of ways. One is that it uses this precursor to the drum machine, an analog rhythm generator. A lot of the sounds on that album, you can't really get them anymore, these particular sounds. There's this real certain warmth and fuzziness and really kind of interesting quality to that music, but you get this sort of dense underbrush of percussion in Dark Trees. It's kind of spooky. You have a lot of sort of echo. You kind of feel when you're listening to In Dark Trees that you're wandering through a dark forest late at night. You're not exactly sure where the sounds are coming from. It's a slightly haunting, it's not scary, but it's definitely a little bit unsettling. Thank you.
Santiago, under the volcano, floats like a cushion on the sea. Yet I can never sleep here, everything ponders in the night.
One of the interesting things about this album is that I think it's only 5 of the tracks, and 14 of them, that have lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
David Shepherd wrote about, you know, that he quotes him, as a matter of fact, saying he doesn't assume that the meaning of the song is in the lyrics. Sometimes he doesn't even remember the lyrics. And listening to these, you hear these things, and they do, they're sentences, they make sense. But you get the impression that it's the voice as an instrument that is more important than what words are actually being used.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting in that Eno has often said that he was tired of this kind of hierarchy, the voice being in the front. You have the singer in the front of the stage, the drummer in the back. You have a guitar player and a bass player. He wasn't into that anymore. What he wanted was to sort of compress everything together, have everything be on the same level, have these sorts of layers. I definitely think that one of the reasons why Eno is a particularly challenging person for rock critics to write about is simply because rock criticism really grew out of literary criticism and poetry in a lot of ways. There's a reason why so many people write about Bob Dylan. Dylan is somebody where you can really analyze the lyrics, and that's a comfortable place for a lot of writers to be.
And you don't have to write about the music.
Writers being writers love talking about words. It makes sense. And so they love people like Bob Dylan. And you see, Gral Marcus has written book after book after book about Bob Dylan. There's a reason why these really gifted writers go back to people like Dylan or the Stones and the Beatles or whatever. When you have somebody who's like Brian Eno, who is saying, I really don't think the vocals are that important. I really don't think I'm that interested in the lyrics. It really stumps them because they're like, well, then what do we write about? How are we going to say anything about this? Now, for me, I'd spent many years just writing about pure electronic music. And so I love writing about the sonics, about the sounds themselves. I got it. I understood. I actually prefer writing about somebody like Eno rather than breaking down and analyzing symbolism and meaning in rock lyrics.
Listening to you talk, I'm struck by the old statement about sausage. You don't want to watch it made, even if you like to eat it. It didn't do you any damage to dissect Another Green World and find all of the pieces? You're still happy with the whole?
Yeah, no. I mean, my background's in the sciences, which is kind of a very odd background for a rock critic. I viewed this book as a scientific experiment. I had a hypothesis. I had results. I had a conclusion. I don't know where this book is going to lead. I'm going to use the oblique strategies cards in scientific procedure. I wanted to write a book that Brian Eno would actually really like to read.
Do you know if he has?
A friend of his just got in touch with me and was like, hey, I'm meeting with him next week. If you give me a copy, I'll give it to him.
So you're waiting with bated breath?
No, because I didn't write the book to attract attention from Eno. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You didn't write it for him. You wrote it for the world.
I wrote it for other people, and the book in a lot of ways isn't necessarily about Another Green World or discrete music or whatever. It's about the creative process. It's about this universal thing. And the people who have gotten the most out of the book have been these really creative types. They're musicians, they're artists, they're painters, they're writers. And they come up to me and they say, like, this book really inspired me because I never knew this. I never knew that Eno went into the studio like this, and that he was so scared, and he made an album this great, and he was only 27, 28 years old. It's a very inspiring story, and I think it's a very sort of universal story. So a lot of the people who have responded the best to the book didn't really know anything about Eno at all. I had several people read the book who told me they had never listened to Another Green World, and that the book had actually motivated them to buy Another Green World, which they had never heard before. So I had a lot of people who read the book who had actually no concept of what the album actually sounded like.
That's Brian Eno with Spirits Drifting from his 1975 album, Another Green World. Geeta Dayal is the author of the book, Another Green World. Do you have a favorite film or music critic? Or are you yourself an arts critic? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to our Facebook page. Coming up, John Mendelsohn tells us what it's like to be on the receiving end of the music criticism that he's known for dishing out as we conclude our Hour on Arts Criticism. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. In the early 1970s, John Mendelsohn wrote for Rolling Stone and the Los Angeles Times and recorded for Warner Brothers Records as a member of the band Christopher Milk. Mendelsohn has just released a new CD called Sorry We're Open. He spoke with Anne Strangchamps.
Early on, I made the decision that I would try to be the Pete Townsend of rock criticism. Pete Townsend doesn't really play the guitar very well, but, you know, you can't take your eyes off of him. And he's a fantastic showman. In a great many cases where I had to write about something that I didn't really have any strong feelings about one way or the other, I thought that it was just going to be boring if I was sober and responsible. So in many cases, I pretended to be a lot more passionate. Well, not passionate, but I put on a lot more vitriol than I was necessarily the case. I just thought it was a lot less boring, you know, that I would kind of put on a show of my own.
Mm. What's the harshest review you ever wrote?
When I was writing for Cream in the mid-80s, I thought of it as my personal mission in life to try to wipe hair metal off the face of the earth. They weren't really reviews, but I would often write at great length about groups like Motley Crue, whom I detested passionately. As far as reviews, I made a brief comeback in Rolling Stone at the beginning of the 90s, and I was given an album by a group called Warrant to review, and I did my best to try to end their career, but I don't think it worked.
Now, during the 1970s, you were also performing in a band called Christopher Milk. Were you also writing rock criticism right then? I mean, how did it work, trying to balance both making music and criticizing other people's music?
It didn't work very well, Anne. When I look back at it, I'm just flabbergasted by my audacity. I would write a scathing review of somebody one week in the LA Times, and then 2 weeks later we'd be opening for that person. So it made for some extremely uncomfortable moments.
I can imagine. I mean, did you ever feel physically threatened?
I felt that there were clubs I needed to get out of fairly promptly. I mean, it never came to somebody standing in front of me and saying, I'm going to kill you, although if looks could kill, I would have been dead.
And what about other critics? Once you had slammed other groups, they must have felt perhaps that Turnabout was fair play. I mean, I know you wrote for Rolling Stone, and Rolling Stone, on the other hand, once wrote that you sounded like Todd Rundgren with severely inadequate equipment.
Well, that was paraphrased. He said I sounded like Todd Rundgren on a reduced budget or something. No, that was a fairly good one. He was pretty nice. When Christopher Milk's album came out, it got murdered. Mm. So that it was definitely true that other critics resented me.
So what was that like to be on the receiving end of bad criticism?
It was awful, but I had always felt that in a way I don't know, I felt a little bit of pride in myself that I was putting myself out there, and I was putting myself in harm's way, whereas most people are just anonymous and they're behind their desk. And I felt that that was sort of distasteful. I feel that anyone who writes about other people should have the courage to face an audience himself.
Did it make it a little easier to handle being criticized for your music since you were already a critic? I'm wondering whether, you know, in a way you regarded the criticism as a kind of artistic performance also, and so maybe it made it easier not to take it too seriously when other people criticized you.
Oh, no. My psychological makeup is such that if anybody looks at me sideways, I'm devastated. So it didn't make it easier at all.
So you were really laying yourself open for...
Yeah, it was utter lunacy.
Now, you've also been criticized for your criticism. You lived here in Madison, Wisconsin, where I live, for some months a few years ago. And while you were here, I know you wrote a few pieces, including an article about your impressions of the local music scene. What kind of response did you get to that piece?
Well, as I later wrote, I found that the incidence of idiocy in Wisconsin was shockingly high, and all these people who hadn't really read very carefully got outraged that this newcomer who had dared to write for Rolling Stone would dare to say anything other than glowingly positive things about absolutely every group in Madison. Well, I've made the point before, there's a lot of crap in Madison. There's also a lot of crap in London and New York and Los Angeles. I mean, to think that any locale produces nothing but terrific music or art or literature or anything is just mind-boggling. And I encountered a lot of parochialism there.
You've just released a new album called Sorry We're Open. So I guess you haven't given up your dream of becoming a rock star.
Well, I've given up my dream of becoming a rock star, the dream of composing and arranging and performing music that will enhance at least a few people's lives remains alive and will continue to.
I'm curious about one song on the new CD. It's called Dancing About Architecture. And I was wondering, there's a famous saying, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. It's been attributed to Miles Davis and Elvis Costello and probably some other people. But I wonder, is that song inspired by that saying?
Well, I was aware of that observation, which I think is the pinnacle of inanity. I had written a song involving an architect, so just whimsically I chose that title for it.
She's waltzing with an architect. His eyes are blue, his beard is flecked with gray. She means no disrespect, insane fatigue has claimed her. But no, he says the orchestra has just warmed up. Adjust your bra and lovely gown of taffeta, and with me cut some more rug.
Where did the title for the album come from? Sorry, We're Open.
That idea occurred to me, and it was very amusing to me. It was like a sign that you would see in a shop run by people with self-esteem issues.
Do you have a particularly favorite song on the album?
I like My Country Tortured. I'm very proud of that. I like to imagine that it's one of the most eloquent denunciations of that practice that has been set to music.
Babylon, we've had our way so long. We're never wrong. Moonlight makes right. Its hell is minor while a wealth is major. Let's retain perspective here. The nether said where once an orchard grew to ascertain how much our prisoners knew. My country tortured.
The The whole problem I have with that idea of writing about music is like dancing about architecture, which I find deeply annoying, is writing is virtually synonymous with thinking or talking. And who doesn't think about the music he or she likes? Who doesn't talk comparatively? I mean, if it was in fact Miles Davis who coined the phrase, are we supposed to believe that he and other musicians wouldn't sit around and talk about the music that they admired or other artists that they didn't think were so hot? I think that's highly unlikely. It might seem like an extension of myself as a critic to be commenting on the current state of affairs in America, but that's all criticism is sort of writing down your thoughts anyway.
Very often, people talk about criticism and creative work as two different poles, two different types of thought. You know, people even say to be creative, you have to turn off your inner critic, as though these two things are mutually exclusive. I'm wondering what you think.
Well, I definitely think that's true. I mean, in terms of writing, it's impossible to do if you've got your inner critic turned on.
But then how does that work for you, since you've spent such a long time being very critical of other people's music? Is it hard to turn off that inner critic when you get to writing your own music?
The act of creation is much more visceral. If I sit down at the keyboard and I find a melody that I like, I'm not really hearing anything other than my own pleasure. You know, it just feels right to me. Songs evolve. When you make a record, the process of going from having sat down at the keyboard and found a melody you like to having a finished product is a very, very long one and a very multifaceted one. And certainly there are points in that process where I kind of am trying to think in terms of how something is going to be heard. But mostly I'm trying to please myself. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel strongly that music, or really any other art that isn't made to please yourself, is probably not going to be very good.
John Mendelsohn is a singer-songwriter and a music critic. His new album is called Sorry, We're Open. You can find a link to his website on our website, ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. You can buy a copy of the program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 418B, Dancing About Architecture, Arts Criticism. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anthony Cefale, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.